All right. This is our 26th lesson, and we have a new category tonight. And this is called Christianity in the Fourth Century. It's the first part. What we're going to do is we're going to look at a few things in depth later. I'll talk about that. But right now, what we want to do is just give you a good overview of the Christian church in the fourth century. We talked about Constantine in the very early parts of that fourth century, and we're going to kind of move our way up into some successive emperors and how the Christians faced issues and how they answered some of those issues. We wrapped up our general overview of early Christianity in Africa last week, although I have been castigated a little bit that we sort of moved out of Africa a little bit, but hopefully you'll see that some of that ties into some of the things that at least Cyprian and some others had to deal with in those days. We said that when the new emperor Diocletian came to power in AD 284, he divided the empire into west and east, and he was ruled by what we call a tetrarchy, a rule of four. We discussed how that Constantine in AD 306 came to power in the west, and then finally in AD 312 marched against Maxentius at the Milvian Bridge in Rome and kind of became that emperor of the western part of the empire. He was victorious, and he owed his victory to the God of the Christians, whose sign he had seen in the sky prior to the battle. Just exactly when, we don't know. But he saw this sign, in this sign, conquer, and so he did. He gives credit to the God of the Christians. We went over that very familiar story. The night before the decisive battle, he had seen a vision, maybe a dream. He heard some words. Nobody else seemed to hear that, but he did. And that he heard, in this sign, conquer. And we saw that was what we call the Christogram, the sign of the first two letters in Greek of Christ's name, Chi, which to us looks like an X, and a Rho, which to us looks something like a P. And you put those two together. You've probably seen that symbol in various writings, or maybe you've passed churches or something. You may have seen that symbol. We noted two of the most prominent historians who left us a record of that account, not a firsthand record, but a secondhand record. We talked about Lactantius. He was an early Christian writer who he actually became an advisor to Constantine. Then you had Eusebius. Eusebius was a Greek. He was a Christian historian. He was an exegete. He was also a polemicist. And in AD 314, he became a bishop of Caesarea. And he, maritime Caesarea, there were two, one Caesarea Philippi and this one Caesarea. He became bishop of Caesarea there, and he was a scholar of the Bible, and he was regarded as probably one of the most learned Christians in early antiquity. And so we're very thankful for his history and his writings for us, because we wouldn't have this. At least we wouldn't have it as fair a record. And granted, you know, when you're writing histories, and it's a Christian history, and you're a Christian, there may be the temptation to embellish. So we do want to be a little careful, even with Eusebius. But we are so thankful that we have that record from Eusebius. It was finally at the age of 32, Constantine became ruler of Rome in the west. And as again, it was divided into the west and the east, and he was there in Rome, emperor over at least the western portion of the Roman Empire. There are a lot of evidences that portray him as less than perfect. And so some of his historians will say that he was not truly a Christian. He just took that name and kind of ran with it. I will leave it to you to have a conviction on that. You can study about Constantine's life. And again, I would caution us. We're looking backwards 1,700 years and we don't know what he had to face. So I'm just saying that. But there were a lot of things. He had his political enemies executed. He had his son Crispus killed. He was a very merciless military soldier in all of his campaigns, very vicious. And in the last years of his life, during the Arian controversy, he was drawn into Arianism. So there is that as well. But I would caution you again. I would just ask you to read the book of Judges and read the book of Hebrews. In Hebrews chapter 11, you'll have the name Samson. as one of the stalwarts of the faith. All right, and I challenge you to read about Samson's life in Judges, and you will, okay. So again, just to give a little bit of charity to Constantine again. I don't even know why I'm doing that. I guess because I know my own heart. And so anyway, many people see these things as evidence that Constantine was not truly converted. They are problematic, no doubt about it. But does that mean that Constantine just didn't live his life out in consistency? Or does that mean he was not a Christian at all? Again, I leave it to you in your history reading to come to a conviction on that. I kind of agree with Needham. I think I shared his quote, kind of the last thing we did last week. He said that at a distance of 1,700 years, it's impossible for us to be sure what was really going on in Constantine's heart and mind when he professed the Christian faith. So I just ask for a little charity there. So that kind of takes us up to tonight, a little bit of review of last week. Constantine began supporting the church indirectly, and then later on in his life, very overtly, and we'll talk about that. So while Constantine is the sole emperor in the West, what's happening in the East? Okay, so that's our question for right now. What's going on in the East? Well, as you might imagine, there were tensions between the two emperors there. You had an Augustus and you had a Caesar. The Augustus was Licinius and the Caesar was Maximinus. And those two, of course, were not, they fought because Licinius was very anti-Christian and Maximinus, if I say his right name correctly, was maybe not pro-Christian, but at least not antagonistic against the Christians. Licinius had all kinds of persecutions against the Christians. And then fighting finally broke out between Licinius and Maximinus, and Licinius was the victor. Okay, so you had in the West, the man who called himself a Christian emperor, Constantine, was victorious. And in the East, you had the individual who was anti-Christian, persecuting the Christians, Licinius, as rumor, and now they are the two ruling both halves. Okay, so now in your minds you think, man, how did the West and the East ever really split up? Well, now you have it. That's at least portions of it. There's more, but there's not less than that. That's a big part of it. All right. And so now Licinius is the sole emperor of the East, and it was then in AD 313 that Constantine and Licinius got together, and they at least put out what we talked about earlier, the Edict of Milan. Right, the Edict of Milan, which Lactantius writes about this in his work on the death of the persecutors. And this is what he says, quote, this edict about these, that Licinius and Constantine kind of got together on and agreed upon. He writes this, that it was proper that the Christians and all others should have liberty to follow that mode of religion which to each of them appeared best. And so that pretty much took like a hands-off persecution of the Christians, or really pretty much anyone. And really, you only had Christians and the pagans, right? And paganism was the religion of Rome up until these days. They worshipped all the gods of Rome. So you at least had this a bit of tolerance for Christianity, and they can worship like they wanted to worship. That was it. It granted tolerance to all religions, including Christianity. The Edict of Milan returned all the confiscated church property back to the churches. So that was nice. This edict made the empire officially neutral with regard to Christian religious worship. It wasn't necessarily pro, but not necessarily against. It did not make the traditional pagan religions illegal, nor did it make Christianity the official religion of the empire. And if you read histories of Constantine, they will tell you that he immediately made Christianity the religion of Rome, and that's just not true. That's not the case. This edict, again, did not make Christianity the official religion of the empire. Rather, it placed Christianity among the legal religions of the empire. So it wasn't illegal to be a Christian, and they weren't persecuted, at least at this time. However, Licinius, right, He's along with Constantine. He went ahead with this edict, but he was very anti-Christian, very anti-Christian. He was still a pagan, and over the next decade, he grew in his antagonism, and eventually there was outward demonstrations of persecutions against the Christians in the East, at least under Licinius. He put many of the religious leaders to death, and he destroyed their homes of worship. So even after he had entered into this agreement with Constantine, with this Edict of Milan, he still, after a number of years, said, I'm fed up with it, and he's going to start persecuting the Christians. The historians say that most likely Licinius was suspicious that the Christians were loyal to his rival. And who's his rival? It's Constantine, right? So he's afraid of these people because they're going to be loyal to Constantine. And they could altogether have an uprising and rise against him. So now he's persecuting these Christians for that. So eventually, in 324, the armies of Constantine and Licinius engage in battle. Just as you might imagine, the tensions just grew so much, they began to fight. Victorious is Constantine. We all know that. So Constantine was victorious and at the Battle of Chrysopolis. He took Licinius prisoner and then had him executed. So that's, I told you he was fierce. I told you he was, sort of just savage. But that's what he did. And he is known as Constantine the Great. So you've heard that expression. He's Constantine the Great now. And he is unquestionably the ruler of the entire Roman Empire. He has defeated Licinius in the East, and now he rules and he reigns from Rome as the sole emperor of the empire, beginning in AD 324. In a subsequent lesson, it's going to be, I'm going to say 4 weeks, maybe 5 weeks from now, we're going to discuss Arianism. Arianism is a very important heresy that developed in these days. And the way the church dealt with it is going to be important for us. It'll be very crucial to the direction that the church took. So we're going to get with Arianism and exactly what it was and how the church dealt with it. But before we do that, I want us to take kind of a general overview look at the Christian church in the fourth century. So we've got now Constantine, sole ruler in the whole Roman Empire, and Christianity, if not official, is looked upon favorably. And you would think that, and certainly a lot of the Christians looked at this in excitement, right? I mean, think of how would we feel if all of a sudden in our country, the people who made the decisions, the senators and the representatives, our executive branch, our judicial branch, our legislative branch, all of them said they were Christians and then started acting favorably towards Christianity. I mean, we would be excited about that. But you have an empire, and it's the Roman Empire, and you have an emperor now who has this influence and saying he's a Christian. So now you have the beginnings of a mixing up of the church and the state. And we'll see how that plays out in future days. So we're looking at the life of the church during the days of Constantine and then up through the matters particularly related to the church in the fourth century. And right now we want to look at these events related to church and state. Okay, with Constantine now saying he's a Christian. We said that Constantine did not make Christianity the official religion of the empire. He was, however, the first emperor who did not look positively on paganism, nor approvingly. So you've got, this is the first emperor who did not, when he was setting up shop, as it were, in the empire, did not sacrifice to the pagan gods, which every Roman emperor had done up until Constantine for the last three centuries, right? Since Octavius Augustus, right? In 27 BC, they all worshipped the pagan gods and they all offered up sacrifices to them. This is the first one that did not. However, instead of worshiping the gods, Constantine commissioned a statue of himself. Surprise, surprise. A statue of himself. Holding a cross, right? And that was to be placed in the city of Rome. And it was huge. It was 40-some feet tall. If you want to learn about, just Google the Colossus of, no, Google, use the search engine of your choice, and type in the Colossus of Constantine and read about this thing. It's amazing. It's 40-some feet high, and it's a statue of him enthroned. He's sitting down on a throne, all right? And this thing is 40 feet high, right? I mean, you could put it in D.C. somewhere, right? I don't even know how tall is the... whatever. So instead of worshiping the pagan gods, he had a statue of himself built, and you can read all about it. It was a statue of Constantine seated on the throne. It stood some 40 feet tall, and Eusebius writes about the inscription that was on it, all right? So here's the inscription. It says this: through this sign of salvation, and that has reference to do with the cross that he's holding in his hand. It's probably not a cross like we think of. It's probably a staff, and this is just by the historian's writings. I don't know what it looked like. The statue is destroyed. I think there are pieces of it that they have found. But the hand, I think they found a right hand. But he's probably holding a staff of some kind, and affixed to the top of it is probably that symbol, the Cairo symbol, the X and the R in English, which would be a Cairo, right, in Greek. So Eusebius writes this about through this sign of salvation, that's that cross, through this sign of salvation, which is the true symbol of goodness, I rescued your city and freed it from the tyrant's yoke. And through my act of liberation, I restored the Senate and people of Rome to their ancient renown and splendor. So who's he giving credit to now? All right, it's through this sign, look what I did. All right, so Constantine may have been a little narcissistic, all right, in this. But so there you have it. Eusebius also writes this. He says that the statue's right hand is said to have held a trophy of, a quote, trophy of the Savior's passion with the saving sign of the cross, and I explained what that was. Now, Constantine did a number of things to indicate his inclination towards Christianity. Again, whether he was truly converted or not, at least in his lifetime, he did do these things that were an example of his inclination towards Christianity. Here's five. There's a bunch. Here's five. He brought in a Christian bishop who would act as his official advisor on Christian affairs. So imagine in our government, they ask, who do we like today? Ligon Duncan, to come in and be an advisor to the Senate, right? We'd go, oh my word, this is wonderful, all right? So that's what he did. Number two, he made Sunday, which was the Christian day of worship, an official day of rest for the empire. We used to have that in America, right? We used to have laws that said businesses were closed on Sundays, right? You couldn't buy your shoes on Sunday. You couldn't go shopping for a car on Sunday, right? I think they eventually opened it up to things like pharmaceuticals, right, things of that nature, something necessary for medicine. But it was, you know, for just a restaurant, you couldn't, you know, after church, you couldn't try to beat the Methodists down to the Golden Corral, right? You just didn't do that. It was closed, right, for a reason. It was in honor of the Christian day, which is, shows you how far we've come, hasn't it? So that not only are we glad that they're open, but too many people utilize them. Yeah, that's another sermon. Number three, he had church buildings built with his own money. He paid for the construction of church. We'll talk about two of those. Number four, he donated very generously to a lot of the congregations that were already there. Some of those that were hurting financially, he donated a lot of state money to them. And he allowed bishops to be a part of the legal system. People could bring their disputes to the bishops if they wanted to. So if two people had a dispute, instead of going to the secular state lawyer or the secular court, they could go to a bishop and have that bishop oversee, and it would have legal force to settle that debate between those individuals. And again, there were a lot more. Probably the single most historic event in Constantine's life would have to be his victory over Maxentius, right, at the Milvian Bridge there at that battle in Rome, when he defeated Maxentius under the banner of that Christogram and naming himself as a Christian in battle and winning. That's, I think, hardly anybody who doesn't know that story. So that's probably the single most historic event in his life. If that's so, then his second most historic accomplishment, or at least one of the top five of his most historic events in his life, was the building of a new capital for the empire. He moved Rome to another place, Byzantium. It was called Byzantium for I don't know how many hundreds of years. And he moved the capital of Rome to that place in Byzantium. The completion of moving the capital, moving, you know, all the legal things they had to do, that was completed in AD 330. And Constantine named it New Rome, right? Neo Roma. I did some reading, I get confused, and I'm welcome to anybody to help me with this. I was under the impression that it did not become Constantinople, named after himself, until later. But in other readings, it says no, in AD 330, when Constantine made Byzantium the new capital, he called it New Rome, it became known as Constantinople, which the city of Constantine, right? So that's what we know. It is no longer Constantinople. It has now been taken over by Islam, and it is now Istanbul, right there in Turkey. Okay, it sits. You know where Istanbul is. I have to tell you where Istanbul. You know where that is. Constantine ordered the construction of a number of impressive churches, right there in Byzantium, known as Constantinople. He built two that are the most famous. One is the Hagia Irene, probably familiar with that name. It was the first church built by Constantine in Byzantium. It was completed around AD 360. Okay? And it was originally dedicated to peace. The Greek word for peace is Irene. And so it's Hagia Irene, Holy Peace, is the name of that church. It still exists, not as a church, but as a museum. Okay, it's been sacked, it's been burned, it's been destroyed, it's been rebuilt, sacked, rebuilt, right? And so I think there might be some pieces that are original, I don't know. It's probably something like the Alamo, if you think about in Texas, you know, how much of it really is still there. And we're going back, you know, 1,700 years. So it's a museum now. The other church that he built was the Hagia Sophia. There's another one. That's probably the more famous one of the two. It was the more impressive. It was the bigger of the two. The Hagia Sophia, probably the most famous of Constantine churches there. It was initially built as, quote-unquote, the great church, because it was massive. It was dedicated by Eusebius in AD 360, of course, after Constantine's death. The Hagia Sophia served as the Basilica of Constantinople, and was one of the largest and most magnificent churches in the Christian world. Later became a mosque and is now it is a museum. So they are both just museums. But that's the work of Constantine there in the new Rome of Constantinople. And even after all these efforts by Constantine, paganism was still the predominant religion in the empire. More people were pagans than Christians, at least in these days. That did not stop Constantine from seeking to influence the Christian faith from a political perspective. So here's where we get into the church and the state issues with Constantine. There were two controversies that arose in the church, and Constantine, as a secular emperor, right, he sought to influence those issues. One of these was the issue known as Donatism. Donatism was a Christian sect leading to a schism in the church. And basically that was in the region of Carthage. See, I could say we're still back in North Africa if I wanted to. So this happened in Carthage. And it started in the 4th century, lasted up until about the 6th century. Because the persecutions under Diocletian, there was a rather severe split that happened in the church at Carthage. I mean, we talked about some of that earlier. Many of the Christians in Carthage did not like the new bishop. The bishop, his name was Cecilian. Here's why they didn't like him. It was reported that he was ordained by another bishop who had surrendered scriptures to be burned during the Diocletian persecutions. Remember when we talked about the Diocletian persecutions and what we called the lapsi, those people who lapsed in their faith and then wanted to come back into the fellowship, and you had a fight between Cyprian and some others about how that was going to take place. Well, you had people that were baptized under some of these people that had stepped away from their faith. Cecilian apparently was one of those. That he was baptized by somebody who, during the Diocletian persecutions, didn't want to die, and he surrendered scriptures to them. He said, I'll give you these scriptures, and probably recited some kind of oath to a pagan god. I don't know. But he did surrender scriptures. And people didn't like that. They didn't want him being the bishop of that church in Carthage. So the church split into two separate churches. One was led by a Cecilian there in Carthage. The other was led by a man named Donatus. So we had this split. Donatus was one. Well, you'll remember that during the Diocletian persecution, a lot of churches had their properties confiscated, had their properties taken away. And then I said they were able to get their properties back again. Remember I said that earlier in our lesson tonight. Well, when Constantine came to power, he restored those confiscated properties, as I said earlier. And in Carthage, the property went to Cecilian and his followers there in Carthage. That angered the Donatists. Remember I told you the Donatists followed Donatus? So the others followed Cecilian. You had the split. That angered the Donatists, and they said that they were the true Catholic Church in North Africa. So what happened? How are we going to settle this conflict between these two groups? Constantine intervenes. This is a church affair. And the emperor gets involved. So Constantine commissions a series of church councils to decide the issue. And without going into a lot of details, it was decided against the Donatists. So they were considered out. So this caused a great deal of anger in the Donatists, because the favor went to the church there under Cecilian. And so a lot of violence broke out. A lot of hot-headed people. Violence broke out between these two Christian groups there in Carthage. And so Constantine had all the Donatists exiled, and he confiscated all of their church properties that they had attained at the time. So Constantine, after a few years, realized that this did not bring peace in Carthage. Right? So in AD 321, he rescinded the orders against the Donatists. What year was it? I can't remember. Anybody taking notes? What year did I say that happened? Maybe I didn't. I didn't say what year. Anyway, so Constantine realizes that this isn't helping. So he rescinds his order. However, for the next 100 years, there would be a tremendous schism between the Donatists and the Catholic Church. And you all know what I mean when I say Catholic Church, the true church. That was the universal church. But a lot of the damage has been done now, because now you have, again, for the first time, an emperor who is now asserting himself into the affairs of the church, not only with legal matters, but now with theological matters. And so the state is intervening with the church. There was another issue that arose during these days of Constantine, not only the issue of the Donatists, but the Arians. And again, I told you we'll deal with that in a few weeks. We'll get into all the details of all of that. I just want to make a few brief statements about it right now regarding Constantine's involvement in that controversy. It's noteworthy for us because for the first time in the church's history, a council of the bishops was brought together by the order of a Roman emperor. This was not just a council to get together. You know, there had been numbers of councils that got together to deal with heresies. We've talked about a few of those. But those councils were brought together by the discretion and the impetus of the bishops of those areas, and they brought this together. This time, it's Constantine who orders them, even though the bishops did not order it. Constantine ordered it. So it's the first time that you have something like that done by a Roman emperor. And so you have this combination of church and state. What's instructive for us is that the church was accepting and gladly of this intervention of the emperor into church dealings. So they were happy to go along with it. Even Eusebius of Caesarea was an ardent supporter of having the emperor take such a position in the church. So even he was glad this was going on. And again, we're going to discuss a lot of this in detail later about the founder of Arianism, Arius, and he was found to be a heretic at this council. It is probably the most famous of all the councils, if we could remember, was the Council of Nicaea. Probably a lot of you know it was in AD 325. I suppose if I asked you when was the Council of Thessalonica? You know, we don't remember all of these, right? But that's a big one, right? And it's a big one for a reason, right? A couple of reasons, right? Theological reasons, but also because of this issue with Constantine and the emperor, as the emperor. And it's really remarkable because for the first time in the church's history, a government official has banished an individual from the church. You have the Donatists were not banished; they were excommunicated. But the Arians were banished, and not by a church, but by the emperor himself, not because they were murderers, not because they were thieves, not because they burned down cities, but because they didn't agree, and they were put out. And so it was really pretty much unheard of to have an emperor do that in the name of Christianity. So now we have the government interfering not only with the church affairs, but in determining what their theology should be. And that's, we're going to see this, that's just the seeds of it. And we know our history. And we know that as time goes on, you're going to have this constant intermixing so that the person who is the head of the state is the person who is also the head of the church. The church was accepting and very supportive of this arrangement, at least in these days, which, as we all know, led to the emperor behaving as the head of both the church and the state. And of course, we'll see that future development as we work our way through subsequent lessons. So that's kind of a short summary of just this portion of the church in the fourth century, basically as it relates to the church and state and how we kind of see this getting together. Because you say, well, how did that ever happen? This is where it began. This is the seeds of it started here, at the development of the state church in the Roman Empire. And we knew that earlier in Armenia, that was the first actual proclamation of a state that was Christian. But this is the first of it in the empire, the Roman Empire, where you have the church and the state combined under Constantine. All right. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we thank you for the opportunity to share these simple words of things that we know from history. And I pray that they truly would be instructive for us, that we would look at these things and recognize that the state, the civil authorities, the civil magistrates have divine authority over those areas over which you've given them authority. And the church has authority in theological matters. And I pray that we would recognize the difference between the two. Please bless in our time of prayer to follow, and we carefully ask this in Jesus' name and all for his sake. Amen.